Thank you so much, and thank all of you folks for being here. How did I get started? No, that's really not a good place to start. because in media, the years just kind of churn along. And so I started many more years ago than I can even remember, and the real bottom line is before I got to wear a media badge, I was wearing a police badge. For 4.5 years in Washington, D.C., I was on the tactical squad, and so I was one of those guys standing out there with a helmet and a baton trying to protect J. Edgar Hoover and all of the other folks around my hometown of Washington, D.C. All right, well, and then there came a 40-year career in media and retirement back in May of 2013, but all of that's just kind of stuff. I'm actually happy to be standing here with the little whiskers so I can actually say that, yeah, I did all that stuff, and I managed to survive it. Before we dive into the subject matter tonight, and I'm really pleased that all of you care enough about what's happening here, whether Netflix brought you here or not, it's okay. This is very, very important for this country and very, very important for so many people like you who would like to plug in to the fact that there are thousands of people in our jails and prison systems who are innocent of the crimes that sent them there. Now, one of the extremely important cogs in the wheel of addressing this problem is with us for just a few minutes at the top of our little presentation tonight, and I'd really like to bring Professor Dave Moran up front just to say a couple of words. But please, Dave is one of the co-founders of the University of Michigan Law School's Innocence Clinic. He'll probably tell you briefly what the difference is between the clinic and a project and that kind of thing, but Dave is one of the genuine heroes of what this is. So, Professor Dave Moran.
Well, thanks, Bill. I wasn't actually prepared to speak tonight. And so I was just going to stop by and say hi. I direct now the Michigan Innocence Clinic, which I co-founded with Bridget McCormick in 2009 and until we lost Bridget to the Michigan Supreme Court in 2012. So we are a student-run, student innocence clinic. We have law students who are investigating cases of wrongful conviction and litigating them in court, and we're in court all the time. We'll be in court on September 7th in a case that's going to be in Detroit in the news quite a bit. We've had two high-profile exonerations this summer. Lorinda Swain, who was our third woman and 12th person exonerated by the clinic since we started in 2012, was exonerated of sexually abusing her son. And we were also co-counsel in the exoneration of Devante Sanford, which probably many of you heard about this summer, who was wrongly convicted of 4 counts of murder in Detroit when, in fact, the murder was carried out by a hitman and his accomplice. It's a pleasure to be here with Bill because Bill is part of Proving Innocence, and we have an arrangement in the Michigan Innocence Clinic with Proving Innocence. They help us investigate cases. And so the work that we do primarily as a non-DNA innocence clinic, you've probably mostly heard about DNA innocence projects, and there is a DNA innocence project in Michigan. It's at Cooley Law School in Lansing. But we are a non-DNA project, which means we go out and do the gumshoe work. We investigate. We knock on doors. We talked to witnesses. I spent this morning with a student talking to a witness to a double murder. And we look at forensic evidence of all sorts, bullets and blood and autopsies, all that sort of stuff. And to the extent possible, we have the students do that work. We have the students go out and talk to the witnesses and talk to the experts and visit the crime scenes. But there are a lot of situations where we really need pros. And when we need pros, we turn to Proving Innocence, an organization that Bill founded in
a number of years ago.
And so since we've been started, we have partnered with Proving Innocence, and in situations where really sticky situations where we really need a professional private investigator, and it's too much for a law student and a professor to go out and try and solve the case, we call on them, and they have done tremendous work in case after case for us, helping us in some cases decide not to take the case because it's not as strong a case as we thought, and in other cases finding that missing piece of evidence that we need to go ahead and take a case and try and litigate somebody's innocence. So it's a real pleasure to be here with Bill, and he has done tremendous work both as a police officer and in his post-police career as an investigative journalist, and now as a private investigator with Proving Innocence. So I'll turn it back to Bill. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. He wasn't expected to speak, but there's no way that the professor can come in a room and you not have them stand up in front of the class and have something to say. But what's really fabulous about that whole organization is that the students who are trying to get to be good lawyers in this country actually get to do hands-on work in cases of actual innocence. It allows those young individuals to essentially examine much more than the nuts and bolts or the cranking wheels or essentially the process and procedure that essentially they will have to follow once they actually pass the bar, get a P number, and move on with their lawyer lives. It's been a little warm around here. I don't know if it's 80s or 90s out there today, but I thought it might be nice to start our little time together with a place that is properly hot, warm, and sometimes enjoyable. Under the Florida palm trees outside a convention-sized hotel, this looks like countless other big business getaways for employees and their families. But look closely, and the gathering displays much more emotion, more pain, even struggle than you might expect. Because more than 140 of these people are special, very special. Part of their lives before they got here were spent in prison after serving years, if not decades, behind bars for crimes that they were in no way responsible for. They are now free, thanks to the heroic efforts of some of the other people in attendance.
I spent 27 and a half years in prison, wrongfully convicted.
Me spending 30 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit, losing all of my 20s, my 30s, my 40s. You know, I lost my mom, my dad.
I was in prison for 17 years.
18 and a half years in prison.
I did 17 years.
20 years, 6 months, 8 days.
I was exonerated on October 15th, 2014.
I sort of lost hope for a minute because I couldn't get legal help fast enough and soon enough.
For me, it was years of struggle of trying to find somebody to listen to me.
I think if the system is really serious about curbing wrongful convictions, I just think that accountability is important.
For far too long, prosecutors have gotten away with sending innocent people to prison. And I'm talking about evidence that's been proven for their misconduct.
I feel if a prosecutor do anything outside the scope of the law, he should be punished to the fullest extent due to the fact he's a professional.
I always thought the truth always prevails and that, you know, innocent people don't go to prison. How could that happen, you know? When it's a free country, but it's not free, and you never know. Your life can be taken away in a matter of seconds.
You just heard from some of the folks who have spent a lot of time behind bars and away from their families. That is exactly true. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong associates, sometimes wrong intent, sometimes being naughty and putting yourself in a place where if things go wrong, someone may point at you. The last person you saw, Susan Mellon from California, was a mother of three and living a quiet life near Los Angeles in California. When someone that didn't like her decided to point her out to investigators in a horrific murder of a homeless man who was not only beaten and stabbed to death, but his body was set on fire to try to keep people from determining who was responsible. It turns out that the three gang members who were responsible for that horrific crime were eventually identified and caught. But before those cases got to the point where they could actually be adjudicated, Susan Mellon was swept up by that person who pointed the finger, a known liar, a known drug user, somebody who really shouldn't have been trusted with identifying someone to possibly serve life in prison, but they were. And that's the problem. I take that back. That's one of the problems. There are many many, many problems. But Susan said kind of the right thing there, that it doesn't matter where. You're going to meet someone tonight who was a General Motors employee, who had a part-time job running a bowling alley, whose worst offense was a parking ticket, who may have had a couple of problems with a girlfriend or two, but nothing ever was charged, no real problems, and yet he was about to spend 45 to 60 years in prison for a horrific crime that almost took his life. And yes, it does affect just about anybody. I have met wrongfully convicted individuals who worked on Wall Street. I have met other people who have been wrongfully convicted who live and work on no street. But that's who they are. They are, in many cases, your neighbors. And in many, many cases, they are the people wrongly identified. So let's talk about what actually happens when an individual ends up in jail or prison for something they didn't do. It's not just the loss of freedom, and a lot of people don't really understand that. This is a loss of family. This is a loss of taxable income. This is a loss of support. This is a loss of an element of community. This is a loss of freedom to be like you. And all of you, unfortunately, can find yourself in a situation where somebody in the system is pointing at you for doing something wrong. Just say, by chance, you were pulled over for driving a little fast, and one of the police officers decides that he wants to check you out for using alcohol. There apparently is a little test unit that only costs the police departments $2, and they can use that to test to see if your alcohol level is within the law, and guess what? The darn thing may work and it may not. They're actually finding these days that as much as 46% of those little test kits give false positives. So yeah, it most certainly could be you. It most certainly could be you. Think about the viability of entire neighborhoods where someone is listed on the sex offender registry. So suppose that person ended up on the registry for a crime that they did not commit, that someone who said they did a certain thing actually turned out to be lying. We wait years, if not decades, to hear that person sometime take back that statement to say, no, the sexual assault didn't really happen. And so who should we be pointing at? Well, I guess there's real concern about how much we can trust the entire system. It is adversarial. We've already heard that. The criminal justice system is an adversarial process, and it goes step by step by step. And in the law, there is plenty of structure, and there is process and procedure, and you start with being a suspect, and maybe there's enough proof, and you become a person who's charged, and from being charged, there's some adjudication, some determination in court by a judge or a jury. You know all of these things, and you get to a point where someone says guilty, and then that person can go off to prison. Well, you heard these ladies and gentlemen up here mention prosecutors. Just understand that all of what happens in the process and procedure of the criminal justice system is essentially in writing, and their structure, and there's supposed to be protections, but really what we're talking about is a human endeavor. So there are individuals who don't do the right thing. Now, that may be painful for a lot of people to essentially accept and swallow, that someone sworn to be a prosecutor, someone sworn to be a police officer, to uphold the law, to seek justice, and there's a little word that fits in all of this scenario. It's called truth. It's called truth. And there is a problem in lots of cases, in all of these cases, finding what is true and what is not. And sometimes when those bits and pieces and cogs of the wheel know what the truth is, the truth doesn't get elevated to the point where it is judged. And that is a serious problem when it comes to the issue of wrongful convictions. There are many, many, many situations where science is helping the process get to where it needs to be. But unfortunately, we only since 1989 or so in the criminal justice system recognize the importance of, the value of, the accuracy of DNA evidence. And yes, we all know how important it is because we read about it, we've heard about the DNA exonerations, we know that it can get you there, get to the point where there's real justice, real understanding of what is true and what isn't. But there are times when the process falls short of even allowing truth to come to the table. And that continues to be a problem for so many people. The Netflix piece. How many of you sat through the entire 10 hours of Making a Murderer? Anybody? Okay, well, one of my board members. And I couldn't sit through 10 hours of it, mainly because I know where it came from. Those very lucky two producers managed to start the process way back when it started with Stephen Avery, and they were collecting video for 10 years, if not more. And so they had a lot to work with, and they could develop questions. And a lot of people say that that presentation may have been skewed, may have left out points of fact that may have leaned more towards guilt than innocence. I didn't want to be a part of that conversation. And there's the good reason is that that was a debate that Netflix drove, and Netflix has had huge success putting out there. And yes, it may lead to another situation like Serial. How many listen to the blog that is called Serial? Who knows about that one? All right, well, this was a young man who, because of the national attention and the many ears that listened to all the hours of that blog on NPR, right? That young man may find himself back in court for a new trial because there were legitimate questions about the process and the procedure and the facts presented and whether or not he really got a fair trial. Let me tell you that on average, someone who raises their hand and says, I'm not responsible for any of this, and I can help you prove it, it takes on average 9 to 11 years if you manage to be one of the lucky ones to get back in court. It is not easy to be an innocent person in prison because you really have to be an extremely lucky person to write your claims, your appeals, and get it to the desk of a Professor Dave Moran, of some of his students, to take you from point A to point B to actually start the process of an appeal. And that's another place that really grinds in my stomach, because the word appeal, just because it's available, doesn't mean it's real. There are too many barriers in the area of appeal and some of the earlier process and procedure that literally are barriers to the truth. Now, I'm being extremely simplistic about that statement, so I don't want you to take it totally to heart. But what I would like you to do is to go to the National Registry of Exonerations. And the gentleman who spoke to you from the University of Michigan is a part of the creation and maintenance of that information, the National Registry of Exonerations. And what it will tell you, and I think today the number is 1,860 or so, I didn't take a look, but that's the number of people who are now free after being exonerated, no longer in prison, only since 1989. Now, there's a very, very important element of that, and I'll talk a minute about the list of things that actually cause wrongful convictions. You might have seen in so many television programs that eyewitness testimony or eyewitness identification is the number one element that drives wrongful convictions in this country. Some person who thinks they saw and could identify an individual responsible for a crime or put a person at a place where a crime was committed And that identification essentially can send an innocent person to prison. 75% of the exonerations on the registry had elements of wrong identification in them. And it's very, very easy for anyone in this room to essentially be tested about the accuracy of being able to identify anybody for anything. Some non-crime, and you can pick out your neighbor only because you kind of know the structure of your neighbor's face. Never mind, you might be looking at a guy who looks so much like your neighbor that you could say, that's Bob, or that's Tom, or that's Harry. It's difficult. False confessions and incriminating statements. You would be surprised at the numbers of cases that go all the way to send someone to prison because the court is presented with something called a confession. It doesn't have to be real. As a matter of fact, in this case, it wasn't. The young man in the striped shirt in the middle is now 23 years of age. His name is Devontae Sanford. Have any of you seen elements of this case in the newspapers and on television? Devontae looks good here, walking away from prison. He has sounded really great for a 23-year-old young man who never got a chance to go to school because at 14 years of age, he essentially found himself confessing to a multiple murder on the east side of Detroit on Runyon Street, where four people were shot to death. And one person managed to survive. Five people shot inside this one house that happened to be producing marijuana. And this young man, whose IQ at the time was 60, who really was kind of making friends wherever he could find friends, walked up to the yellow tape outside of that house. And he said to the officer, I know what happened here. And pretty quickly, the investigators were in action, and he was giving them names. And within a matter of 24 hours, the police investigators had run around the neighborhood and collected four individuals that he named, and all of them had alibis. None of them were even close to this crime. None of them had anything to do with it. But Devontae had named them, so they had to go check. They checked on the first group. There was even another group. He gave them more names. Instead of it being kind of a normal process of investigation, this turned out to be an assembled case. Have you ever known of a murder suspect getting ridden around in a police car with three investigators and a supervisor, just kind of chatting about things? What he actually was learning in that police car was elements of the crime that he knew nothing about that he later provided a confession for. This is injustice. This was a wrongful conviction based on a confession that wasn't true. Yet, his youth was taken. Yet, his life now has to start over again. He has to get a GED. He has to get a driver's license. He has to get a job. He has to get a life. And not be affected by the fact that he became, inside prison, a gang leader. How do you separate yourself from the gang that essentially kept you alive among adults in prison? This is what we talk about when the loss of employment, the loss of family, the loss of freedom are all a part of what wrongful conviction means. And yes, in this country, we are beginning to recognize more. We are beginning to recognize more that there are many, many, many thousands of people in jails or prisons who did not do, were not in any way responsible for any of what sent them to prison. Jailhouse snitches is another reason for wrongful conviction. Someone on the inside of a jail or a prison who is approached in many cases by police or prosecutors to say, gee, that guy in the cell next to you, he said this, that, and the other about a crime. Dave actually mentioned Devontae Sanford. The university and the Innocence Clinic were a part of the effort to get him out of prison. A judge essentially gaveled his freedom. They were ready to go back to court to show the true elements of what the crime that sent him away was really all about. It was about a hitman. It was about an adult who had an associate who was paid thousands of dollars to kill the person who was growing marijuana in the house on Runyon Street. His name was Vincent Smothers, and he didn't know this kid from Adam. He didn't know him. But just a matter of weeks after he went to prison for the crime he had nothing to do with, Vincent Smothers was arrested for getting paid for killing the wife of a Detroit police sergeant. And so he came into the police headquarters and started talking. And by the time he finished talking, he had confessed to 12 different paid murders. Guess what? The four people killed on Runyon Street, Vincent Smothers was responsible for, not this kid. So what did Vincent Smothers do? What was he able to do? Vincent Smothers was able to convince the Wayne County prosecutor that he really had killed only 8 people. Not 12, only 8. And the 4 that were left out were the 4 that she decided not to believe. So she put together a nice sentencing package for the paid hitman, and so he gets to do 50 to 100 years for 8 murders. They left the 4 out because they already had their man. It happened to be this 14-year-old diminished child who was in prison. Yes, I get kind of wound up about this case because early on, about a year after he was in prison, those facts started to come to me, and I started telling stories on television. And literally before I did my first story, I walked into the editorial boards of both newspapers, and I told them what I knew. And they did their stories, and we together elevated this to a national tragedy. We are so pleased that this year, on June 8th, he was able to walk to his freedom. Vincent Smothers is still in prison, and no, the Wayne County prosecutor has not charged the hitman who confessed to the killings with murder. This is the arc of wrongful conviction. It is misconduct. It is failure to perform your jobs. It is to ignore what you are sworn to do in the criminal justice system. One of the really big elements of what happens in the process and procedure has to do with science. Now, we are very, very, very fortunate tonight to have someone who knows a lot about DNA evidence. As a matter of fact, his business essentially is surrounding that. I'm going to ask Howard Cash to come up and just give you a tad, just a tad, because we could be talking about this particular element of science for a long time. Let me say before Howard comes up that junk science in the history of criminal justice system, like bite marks, which are so incredibly unreliable, it's just not even worth talking about. Testing hair follicles turned out to be, after too many decades, the wrong way to identify someone who may have been at a crime scene. Howard, come up and just tell folks just a little bit about what you do, your company, and why DNA is so important in the criminal justice system. Everybody, would you welcome Howard Cash, please?
I also came here not planning to say anything. our main speaker wanted a break, I think, so. So my name is Howard Cash. I'm the president of Gene Codes Corporation, which is about a nearly 30-year-old company that does, it's a software company, just all of the softwares for DNA analysis. And every drug company in the world uses some of our software. Back in 1996, the Armed Forces DNA Identification Lab, people in the field know it as AFDL, called us and they said they need help with some of the process of identifying remains of service people, you know, going by statute to the beginning of the Republic, but in practice usually back to the First World War. So AFDL was involved with identifying, many here are old enough to remember when the Vietnam veteran was removed from the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And I was already working in biotech at the time, and I was one of the people who was against that. I thought, why would you do that? Everyone who had someone who didn't come home can walk by that monument and say, maybe my husband, maybe my father, maybe my son is in there. And if you could identify them, what good does it do? And you will never feel that way if you ever meet anyone in Michael Blassie's family. And he's been reinterred in a military cemetery in St. Louis. And that's what first got me interested in this. But AFDIL called because you're all familiar with OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So AFDIL is part of the Department of Defense, and they were told that the laboratory is an unsafe work environment because the people looking at the screens all day, every day, at these little colored wavy lines of DNA, were changing eyeglass prescriptions every 6 months. And they said, so they have to find a way to do that more safely. I thought, now, of all the jobs in the Department of Defense, this does not seem like the most dangerous one. And so we got involved in that. And it was, more of a public service than anything else. And it was always like a small part of what we did until 9/11 came along. And the World Trade Center came down, and 2,749 people were covered in 22,000 pieces. And
1,115 were completely vaporized. And the nuclear attack on New York City by Israel, by the way.
Oh, please.
If you do your research, do 2 plus 2, Israel, New York City, and 9/11. You were talking about these 20,000.
There was a big effort to identify the remains of the people, and there wasn't anything to do with this. If you watch crime dramas, you know about CODIS. The FBI database. I don't want to talk long, but I want to mention this one thing. So CODIS wasn't able to do this, and that's why we were hired. We ended up doing a lot of work and developing a lot of tools and found out a lot about a lot of the deficiencies in the legal system. So CODIS isn't that accurate. For doing a direct match, you find DNA on a cigarette and you match to somebody, that's fine, usually. So I'll give you just one example. There's a case that people in the field know of, John Puckett in California. You know this case. So back in 1972, a woman, a nurse, was coming back from her job at UC San Francisco, very close to where my wife grew up. And she was assaulted in her home. Her landlady heard the noise, went upstairs, and someone in a hoodie came out and told her, who she didn't recognize, said, "Go away, we're making love." She ran down, called the police, and by the time the police arrived, Diane Sylvester was dead. And although there was a suspect who was never pursued, the case just lay fallow until 2003, when someone took an oral swab, a sample from the victim, and tested it for DNA. And typically, you check 13 numbers. Think of it just like combination lock. If you have if you're only checking 1 out of 10, got a 1 out of 10 chance of hitting something, right? Then you have two numbers and three numbers and four numbers. 13 numbers gives you a lot of information. They only got 5.5. But it matched somebody in the California criminal database, someone who'd been previously convicted. They went and got him. He's 70 years old now. But it was 30 years had passed. Did he do this when he was 40? He said no. He cooperated. When he left the state for a while, he told the police. He said, I'm completely innocent. And he went to court and said, well, there's only a 1 out of 1 million chance, a little more than 1 out of 1 million chance that any two people would match this. That's pretty compelling. But there were already 300,000 people in the California database. You don't have to be a forensic scientist or a mathematician to know if you got a chance of 1 out of 1 million, you try 300,000 times, you got a 1 out of 3 chance of finding somebody. So it was just kind of a random chance they got it. Now, the important thing is that the prosecutors argued with the judge that if this is explained to the jury will be confused. And so rather than risk confusing the jury, this man went to jail. And by all accounts, he's a terrible guy, and he's a mean guy, and people don't like him. And there was clearly not enough evidence to convict him. I think of that as prosecutorial misconduct. You're withholding information that was clearly material to his innocence. One change that can be made, and I think should be made, and has been recommended by the National Science Foundation, is crime labs, I personally don't think, should be part of the Department of Justice. You don't want to be on the prosecutor's side. In a lot of places, in New York City, the crime lab is part of the Department of Health. It should not be part of the prosecutor's team. That's something that could be changed, and I think it should be.
All right, thanks so much. I really appreciate that. At Northwestern's law school, there is something called the Death Penalty Information Center. Not long ago, Death Penalty Information Center, right? And once again, you can look them up. Northwestern is also very active in this area of wrongful conviction. They took a look at, not too terribly long ago, 86 death row exonerees and their cases. And what they determined is that 45 of the 86 were victims of eyewitness error. A snitch was involved in 10% of the wrongful convictions. Government misconduct, 17 of the 86. 8 from false confession. 9, junk science, when DNA was not available, or someone who collected elements of evidence that looked like a good DNA sample failed to collect it properly. Anybody know the name Barry Scheck? He happens to be one of the dream team lawyers for a fellow named O.J. Simpson. And if you watched some of that, it certainly appeared that this lawyer, Barry Scheck, a really sharp guy, used DNA evidence to help O.J. Simpson get himself a not guilty verdict that he didn't really deserve. I'm sorry, I will take that hard line position. He was guilty as hell. All right, so anyway, but Barry Scheck, as it turned out, in that trial, in that very public forum, laid out elements of the importance of properly collecting DNA evidence so that it could be used properly in the process and procedure that is a criminal prosecution. Sometimes the science fails, as in this case.
The way the trial was going, I wasn't allowed to have any character witnesses. My attorney didn't bring any medical experts to defend me. And basically, we just had two medical experts from the state side basically painting a portrait of a monster. In September of 2005, I was convicted, and then I was sentenced to 10 to 15 years. Where they sent me was called Scott's, and it was located in Plymouth, Michigan. After the initial 30 days, I had to go to a level 4 housing unit, and then you're locked down for pretty much more than 16 hours a day. You're locked in your room, and it's a 6x6 area. Very small area, and you have a roommate, so you have two bodies in a very small, closed space. My conviction was a very, very, it was a big shock to the people in my circle, in my community, and so everybody just, they withdrew because they didn't know how to deal with it.
Nobody knows how to deal with having their freedom taken away. The young lady you just met on tape there was working in the mortgage business. Looking forward, essentially, to having a good life with a nice guy and raise some children and make some money financing houses. No trouble in her life at all. But she was a caring person, and so when her sister needed someone to take care of her child, she stepped forward. Apparently the child had some medical issues, but Julie had no problem taking care. No problem at all, except that some of the child's injuries ended up in a hospital, and the evaluation certainly appeared to the doctors and eventually a prosecutor to be child abuse. That young lady, after not having anything to do with wrongdoing, found herself tried not once but twice, and she spent almost 5 years in prison. She is among those now free. And imagine somebody who just had a really good job at General Motors, apparently one of the higher paid people, and also had family and friends and children. Well, he too found himself butting heads with the police on one really ridiculous occasion, and the two cops apparently remembered because they were drunk and in the bowling alley, and because Kenny said, gee, you guys shouldn't be here, you should go home, that he was identified as somebody not favorable to the police. A couple of minutes to meet Kenny Winemko.
I lost almost 10 years of my life. I had my name dragged through the mud. I was called a menace to society, and I seriously considered hanging myself. When I heard those words, guilty, I felt like somebody hit me with a stun gun.
Believe it or not, Ken Winemko was living out a nightmare that he never imagined. Convicted in 1994 for the brutal rape and robbery of a 28-year-old Clinton Township woman, Winemko was sentenced to 40 to 60 years in prison for a crime he knew he did not commit.
I couldn't understand how something like this could happen in our system. He said, I failed to show remorse. My response to him was, Your Honor, I feel terrible for what happened to this woman, but I can't show remorse for something I didn't do or have any knowledge of.
Samples of his blood, hair, semen, and saliva were compared to those collected at the crime scene and eliminated him as a suspect.
I thought I actually died and I was in hell. They had the wrong man. I'm innocent.
In a 5-year span, Ken's appeals were denied by both Michigan and federal courts. He was beginning to lose hope that his case would be overturned. Then, in 1999, he decided he would turn to an unlikely source for help.
It's not uncommon to receive letters from prisoners, and you know, usually it's just kind of like, yes, everyone's innocent. The police department claimed that, you know what, other people have checked this out. They've all found out it's, you know, a waste of time. Don't waste your time, Kim. And I said, well, I'd like to look for myself. I don't think he should be here. I really don't think he should be here.
I am very pleased to introduce for your questions, your concerns, your compassion, my friend Julie Baumer and my other friend, the guy with more hair than me, Kenny Winemko, please.
Thank you so much.
I was fortunate enough to be a reporter at the time of the release of both of these people. I didn't have anything to do with it. It was kind of another story for me to cover as a reporter. I had covered other reporters, other stories about wrongful conviction. But one of them not only caught my eye, but caused me to do a 5-part series on a fellow named Frederick Thomas Freeman, who went to prison for a horrible broad daylight murder on a college campus in Port Huron, Michigan. 1986, and supposedly a few minutes before 9 o'clock, there was a single shot from a shotgun, pretty loud, and it cut down a young college student named Scott Macklem, who happened to be the son of Croswell's mayor. Well, the police, in a roundabout way, identified Kensu as being the person who was responsible for this killing. Now, the stories I did were called the Ninja Killer, because Kensu was a person who was a multiple black belt in lots of different kinds of martial arts. And so for him to have used a shotgun to kill somebody was ludicrous on its face. But the police decided that his claim of being more than 400 miles away in Rock, Michigan, outside of Escanaba, still meant that he must have been the person who kill the young person with a shotgun all the way down in Port Huron. It is that kind of lunacy that you see over and over and over again in this area of wrongful conviction. But I'd like to ask Julie to kind of tell this audience what you feel they need to hear from you based on what little they got to see of the earlier interview from you. And then Kenny will get a chance to speak, and then we'll get a chance to hear from you as to what you'd like to hear from them. Julie, please.
Thank you, Bill. My name is Julie Baumer, and thank you for attending this evening and showing interest in this. Hopefully by being here as an exoneree who was once wrongfully convicted and imprisoned for a crime that I did not commit may be of help to you in understanding and considering the real-life implications and that I and others have and do endure. In 2003, I was 27 years old, with a good job as a mortgage officer, looking forward to marriage and children of my own, and a whole life ahead of me. My younger sister at the time was unmarried, and she gave birth to a son whom she had planned to adopt out. With my family's blessing, I chose to adopt my own nephew to raise him as my own son. My nephew was born prematurely. After a prolonged and very difficult delivery, he needed to spend a few weeks in the neonatal intensive care unit. 6 weeks later, when he was in my care, he suddenly became very ill, and a doctor incorrectly determined that he was a victim of shaken baby syndrome. And the person who had been caring for him, myself, I was charged with first-degree child abuse. I was shocked and devastated, but I was certain that the truth would come out and that I would be acquitted. I loved my nephew, and I had done everything right to care for him. However, my trial lawyer provided only a single expert witness whose specialty was not even qualified to read the CT scans. I was found guilty and sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison. After 4.5 years in jail, my innocence was proven, and my conviction was overturned. When my nephew was diagnosed with a form of childhood stroke, I was completely exonerated because there was never a crime of any kind committed, only a wrongful medical diagnosis. So after 4.5 years in prison, I was suddenly back in the community. I didn't know what to do for housing or employment. My former job at the bank was gone, and reconnecting with friends and even family seemed very difficult and still is. My mother died 2 weeks after my return. Other nephews and nieces with whom I had enjoyed a very close relationship were now aging, and they were uncertain about my returning to the family after being absent for so long, especially after being accused of accusing a family member. In short, I had to start over from scratch as an older single woman with nothing to show for my previous years of toil and effort. The missing years could never come back. They were critical years in building relationships, establishing a family, and acquiring a profession and building a career. Since my exoneration, I have been working hard in menial jobs, struggling unsuccessfully to pull myself up. I have no family of my own. I have no career. Not the future I had always planned for. By no reason of mine, all of this was taken from me. Like most exonerees, there is no one I can sue for my wrongful convictions. The statute of limitations to sue my lawyer passed while I was still in prison. And I cannot sue the doctors who misdiagnosed my nephew's illness because they were treating him, not me. Nonetheless, I strive to move forward, and I continue to aid and assist those from various law schools and legal backgrounds to raise awareness in the epidemic of wrongful convictions, especially those who are falsely accused of SBS. I'm very grateful for the hard work and the students and the staff at the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the U of M Law School. If it weren't for their belief in correcting the miscarriages of justice, I would still be incarcerated in the Michigan Department of Corrections until my scheduled release date, September 21st, 2020. I urge all of you to please help in this movement, contact your local innocence projects, and offer any assistance you may deem suitable. Thank you.
I'm sure you can see that for exonerees to essentially relive those horrific experiences and stolen years is not an easy thing. To stand up against the memories that simply cannot be erased means that you're moving back towards any level of life that you had hoped for is almost impossible. But we are going to continue to stand with Julie and everyone else that finds themselves in this situation. We're very fortunate to have her free, but I can tell you, among the 2.2 or 2.3 million people that find themselves incarcerated in this country, there could be between 0.5% and 4.5% of those who are behind bars in this country who are there for crimes they did not commit. Kenny Wanemko spent almost 10 years in the Michigan Department of Corrections for a horrific crime. So let me have Kenny talk about his situation.
Thank you, Bill. Good evening, everyone. Before I say what I have to say, and I do this no matter where I speak around the country, the first thing I do is I want to thank Almighty God for listening to my prayers, answering my prayers, sending me the good people from the Innocence Project, in my case in particular, on the Thomas Cooley Innocence Project in Lansing, and for them to uncover the truth that allows me to be here tonight with you. I enjoy this so much. It makes my day when I have an opportunity to tell at least one more person about the injustice in our system, so you can go on down the road, you can tell someone else down the road. That's the way we're going to get these problems solved. And believe me, the problems are systemic. No matter what anyone tells you, they are systemic. They are very, very serious problems. It's always a pleasure to be with my dear friend Bill Proctor. When I was released on June 17th of 2003, there were so many reporters there from all over the country, and Bill happened to be the first reporter to stick a microphone in my face. And we've been like brothers ever since, except that I have hair and he doesn't. And before I say what I want to say, too, we have someone here tonight is a very, very dear friend of mine. Without him, I don't know if I'd be here today. His name is Professor Norm Fell. He's the founder and executive director of the Innocence Project at Thomas School of Law School in Lansing. Norm, please stand up so everyone can see you. One of the best men you'll ever find. Pardon? Thank you. Thank you. He's a great guy. You know, when I was, I'm going to touch a little bit on what Bill said earlier. When I was released on June 17th of 2003, I was just the second person in Michigan to be released. The first person, his name was Eddie Joe Lloyd. He was a black gentleman out of Detroit. Eddie Joe did 17 and a half years for a rape and murder he had nothing to do with. Eddie Joe got sick when he was in prison in health. Believe me, I've walked the walk. Julie has walked the walk. Healthcare in prison is non-existent. Trust me. Anyhow, Eddie Joe got sick when he was in prison. He only lived for about a year after his exoneration. But I went to see him about a week before he passed away, and I told Eddie Joe that if the good Lord would call him home, I would keep up this battle for justice for everyone, black, white, man, woman, I don't care who it is. These things have to stop. I told Eddie Joe I'll keep up that battle, and I will never, ever break that promise that I made to Eddie Joe. That's one of the reasons why I'm here today. I've been one of the fortunate exonerees around the country in so many different ways, by meeting people like Norm and Bill Proctor and Mitch Albom and Richard Bernstein. I mean, these people they're like brothers to me. I could never have imagined the people, the good people, that I was able to meet and join projects. I'm on the board of directors of Proving Innocence, as well as the Cooley Innocence Project and the Innocence Clinic at U of M. I'm blessed. I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world after going through hell. And it gives me so much pleasure to take part in bringing more people home. And getting back to my being number two, the second exoneration in Michigan, this is in 2003, when our newest exoneree, Devontae Sanford, Bill and I were there when he walked out a couple of weeks ago. I was number two, Devontae was number 67. So that's a pretty big leap. In Michigan. I was number 129 in the country, and as Bill said today, that number is 1,863, I believe. Those are huge numbers. And believe me, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the tip of the iceberg. These wrongful convictions have to stop. We need everyone's help to join us in any way that you can to get the word out. Call your state reps, your state senators, call Governor Snyder. But the work, we have to stop these wrongful convictions. We can do it. Believe it or not, we can. One of my pet peeves in these wrongful convictions is the problem of prosecutors and police claiming immunity. And we catch them lying, hiding evidence every single day. They did it in my case. The lead detective, who we proved in federal court, was having an affair with the female prosecutor. And the prosecutor was, not only was she sleeping with the detective who withheld the evidence, she was also sleeping with the trial judge. No, I can't make this stuff up. It's a fact. And we proved it in federal court. Yet, these people sent me away. I was sentenced to 40 to 60 years in prison, no criminal history. I was given 40 to 60 because the trial judge said that I had failed to show remorse. And I told the judge, Your Honor, I feel terrible for what happened to this woman. It shouldn't happen to anyone, but I can't show remorse for something I didn't do or have any knowledge of. He says, well, jury found you guilty. We'll see you. We'll see you in 40 years. That's what happened.
One of the members of our audience asked about who gets indicted, who gets punished for their misconduct. And the word immunity, unfortunately, stands in the way of most of the levels of misconduct. In Kenny's case, the prosecutor went inside of a jail cell and had a conversation with a man who she tried to cut a deal with to testify that Kenny had confessed to the crime. And when that guy essentially stepped away from the offer, she found somebody else who essentially had provided snitch testimony in several other cases. Yep. That also was incorrect. Now, that prosecutor, where is that prosecutor today, that assistant prosecutor? She's sitting on a bench in Royal Oak as a judge. The police that were responsible for some of the misconduct, they were all promoted. Some retired. Some died. Some, we're trying to talk to even as we speak. Kenny and a friend are writing a book so that a lot of the misconduct that is in a federal court document can be explained and people can understand that, yes, as much as we really want to trust those who are sworn to uphold the law and to seek truth and fairness and justice, simply do not.
You know, if I can, Bill, I want to touch on this. I'm glad you brought up the subject of the snitch, because if you look at the exonerations around the country, snitch testimony, which in my opinion shouldn't be allowed, four states have banned it altogether, as a matter of fact. During the trial, it was a horrible, horrible rape. The woman was raped over a three-hour period. However, when she called the police, she told the police that the man wore a mask. He had blindfolded her with two pair of her panties, had secured her panties with a pair of pantyhose. When the police got there and they asked the victim if she could help them with the composite drawing, she says, no, I never saw the guy's face. She estimated the guy's height at about 6'2", 6'3", about 220, 230 pounds, about 30 years old. At the time of my arrest, I was 5'10", 185 pounds, 43 years old, okay? And ironically, down the road, as it turned out, the DNA that cleared me ultimately in 2009 caught the actual rapist who was, and the way that happened, he was being ready to be released on parole. And under the current law, the new law, rather, before you can be released, the prisoner has to submit a DNA sample. That sample goes into the CODIS system. That's how the police found the actual rapist. The man is 6'6", 290 pounds. Okay, that's how far they're off on IDs. But getting back to the snitch testimony.
Let me say that again. You were 5'10" and 165?
185.
And 185. And this guy was 6'6" tall and weighed almost 300 pounds and was back then and was at the time of his arrest and conviction on the new case that sent him to prison.
He had a rap sheet a mile long. Okay. Now, getting back to the snitch in my case, at the trial, there was someone from the Michigan State Police Crime Lab came in that testified that the semen hairs, the pubic hair, or semen samples, the pubic hairs found in the victim's bed belonged to someone with type A blood. I was type O. That ruled me out. Fingerprints were collected from the crime scene. Did not match the woman. Her husband, who was out of town for 8 days golfing, didn't match him, didn't match me. Nothing in this case matched me, nothing. Then what the prosecutor did, she brings in the infamous jailhouse snitch, which is a major problem in about almost 40% of the cases around the country. The prosecutor approaches this man. She tells the jury, and this is all a matter of record in federal court. The prosecutor tells the jury she's going to offer this man, his name was Glenn McCormick, the quote-unquote, the deal of the century, that if he will get on the stand and testify, I told him I committed the rape, they would drop all the charges against him. He was facing life in prison as a fourth habitual offender. This is not fantasy. This is fact. So naturally, the guy being a professional liar gets on the stand, says, Kenny told me, he told me he did this, he told me he did that. I never talked to the guy in my life. That's how outrageous many of these cases of wrongful convictions are, not only here in Michigan, but around the country, and they have to stop. They have to stop.
In the state of Michigan, 67 is the most recent number?
Devontae was 67.
Yeah. Devontae Sanford's release on the 8th of June made him number 67. But only four states in the country have more exonerations than the state of Michigan. So we clearly have a problem here, and yes, it takes much, much too long for these cases to get to a point where people like these can find freedom. I could talk about this for a long, long time.
Bill, if I could, I want to add one more point that I just came across, okay?
It's going to cost you $5.
Oh. can you take a check? When I was convicted, when I went to Jackson, it was December 27th, 1994. I'll never forget it. Okay? And my dad passed away when I was in prison, too, and I was not allowed to go to the funeral. When I got to Jackson, my prison number was A240889, A representing a first-time conviction, first-time felon. Okay, your number, once you get a number, it never changes. If you were convicted, you were released and sent back to prison, that A would turn to a B for a second offense, C for a third offense, so on and so forth, okay? I was talking to a mutual friend of ours. His name is Scott Nobles. He was the deputy warden at the Ryan Correctional Center in Detroit, where I spent some number of years there. He's one of the good guy in the MDOC. He's on board with us. I think my case opened up his eyes, too. I was number 240889. I called him last week because I wanted to find out what number are they up to in the DOC now. The current number is 986810. So I've been home, and I got my number in 1994. So what that tells you is, prison is a big business. That's what I want to point out to you. Okay, it's a big business, no bullshit. Okay, I'm going to tell it like it is. Since I got my number, 740,000 new men have come through the system. That's almost 1,000 men a week. That's a scary number. And a lot of the cases are total, total jokes. But they're not a joke to the person that has spent time in prison for, sometimes their whole life in prison. This stuff has to stop. That's why Bill and I and Julie do what we do to bring awareness to everyone here. So please join us in any way that you can.
The organization that brings us here tonight is called Proving Innocence, and we are a small 501c3, but we provide investigators in cases of wrongful conviction and claims of actual innocence. If we provide it pro bono, we still have to figure out a way to pay for that investigative work. Yes, since my retirement from television, I have become a licensed private investigator, but I can't take money that might come through Proving Innocence to help. And so we have elicited the help of a number of licensed private investigators and firms to help us in the state of Michigan. So I never say, gee, write a few checks, but I always say that if what we've had to say here tonight, if the insight that we have provided would move you to help, the first thing you need to do is listen when someone says that they are actually innocent, that they did not do the crime. Don't let anybody say to you, well, everybody in prison claims to be innocent, because that's not true, and it never has been. And so our organization, the University of Michigan, Cooley Law School, and others, and there are 63 of them around the country, innocence projects of various sizes that work on individual cases. The case that Dave Moran mentioned, a fellow named Lamar Munson, 20 years ago as a reporter, I actually did stories on the horrific murder of a Christina Brown, 12 years old. The police said at the time stabbed to death, and that Lamar Munson was responsible for that horrible crime because he essentially was the man providing her drugs to sell crack cocaine on the west side of Detroit. Just before my retirement in 2013, got a call from a woman who said, I got it wrong in my reports, that I identified a man that the police said did the crime, but she was with the man smoking crack cocaine the night Christina was murdered. And now, the first week of September, Lamar Munson will go to court. And after all these years of insisting he was innocent, he finally is going to get a new hearing in Detroit, the same court that sent him to prison, where we are going to be able to argue that, no, both forensic evidence and witness testimony will demonstrate that he has been in prison for 20 years for the crime that I and the police department and other reporters said he committed. So if ever I was looking for a reason that I do this, it's simply to get it right. And that's what you would want from your system, if they make a mistake, is to get it right. Let me thank everybody for being here tonight, to listening to us. There is a microphone in the back, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
If you have any questions, or is it up front? Yeah,
it's right there.
On the back side. We can take questions from that microphone. And if we have beaten you up enough with this information here tonight, let me say that there are so many heroes involved in this process, people who go the extraordinary extra mile to make sure that justice is truly served and that the innocent are freed. If there are no questions, ma'am, please. Yes.
I'm sure that a lot of us would like to know before we leave here exactly whom we should contact and specifically what we should say. What I heard the gentleman saying was that banning snitches, as some states have done, and taking away the immunity of prosecutors and others who are in a position to create this travesty, are two of the measures. Is that correct? And could you answer the other question? Anything else?
I have always believed that the immunity issue is a primary reason for these wrongful convictions. I mean, when I was in school, we were taught, the law is supposed to apply equally to everyone. Man, woman, black, white, cop, judge, dishwasher, That's the way the system is supposed to work. When a police officer or a prosecutor can do what, for example, what they did to my case, withhold evidence, suborn perjury, and a federal court judge, Judge Lauren Zadkoff, wrote a 51-page opinion accusing the detectives and the prosecutor of suborning perjury, withholding evidence, and conspiracy to obstruct. Those are major, major crimes. Those people belong in prison. They do. To what you can do, what I would suggest that not only you but everyone in this room do, is write to your newspaper, local newspaper, state your opinion, call your local state rep or your state senator, and stay on them. Stay on them, believe me. Tell your friends to call them. The more that you put the spotlight on these people that are in power, that abuse their power, that's one thing I've learned over the years. People in power do not like to be put under the spotlight. That's the only way we're going to get these problems corrected. Okay? One other thing, talking about proving innocence, there's some information out there on the table. Please go to visit the provinginnocence.org. Okay? It's a very informative website. You'll gain a wealth of information there. Bill and I and Julie and Tommy hires a young man out of Detroit who spent 25 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. We were on Let It Rip about 3 weeks ago. You can watch that episode on there. Also on their website, there is a, if you go down to the bottom, there you'll see my picture and a picture of Angelo Henderson, who is a radio show host in Detroit. Angelo and myself and Richard Bernstein, another dear friend of mine who's now a Supreme Court Justice, we did a radio program called Fighting for Justice. And we had picked out the 10 best shows that we have done. You can scroll down to the bottom. You can listen to those shows commercial-free. Bill is on there. Senator Beda, Senator Kowal, Carl Marlinga, the Hires brothers, Dave Gavitt. It's a very, very informative way to learn exactly what the hell is going on in our system and how we can stop that from happening. But the immunity in my book, I think Bill and Julie would agree, you get rid of that immunity and slap one or two prosecutors and put them in prison, believe me, the rest of them won't take a chance. They don't have the guts to take a chance. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for sharing your stories. They're very powerful. I'm involved in a couple of groups in Michigan here, the Collaboration to End Mass Incarceration and Nation Outside, which is a group of former offenders who are working to try to help support people who are coming out of prison. There's so many issues in the criminal justice system, and there's just so much injustice there. Is there any kind of a movement to have, is there any legislation pending that we can support to get rid of immunity, or is this just a grass level movement?
As far as the immunity goes, it's a grassroots level. If you talk to a politician and you mention that word, they'll walk away from you. Or if you're an exoneree or someone like Bill, okay? Because again, they don't have any guts. But we're going to have the problem taken care of. As God's my witness, that's going to happen. Another thing everyone here can do is contact your local state representatives about a wrongful compensation for the exonerees here in Michigan. And this is a fact. 30 states have compensation that would pay someone who spent 5, 10, 20, 30 years in prison. Michigan is not one of those states. We have been fighting, and I've been leading the fight for over 9 years to get compensation for someone who spent so many years here in prison. And this is a fact. If you were in prison in the state of Michigan for a crime that you did commit and you are released on parole, the state will help you find housing, job training, food stamps, clothing, which is fair if someone comes out to try to build a better life. However, if you're in prison like Julie and myself and my 65 other brother and sister exonerees, the day that we are released, we get nothing. They wouldn't even say, we're sorry. We get nothing. That's ridiculous. The day of Devante Sanford's press conference, I was with Bill down at the church in Detroit. And we just walked out. Remember, Bill, we got the Senator Peter called me. He said that the bill had passed, finally passed the Senate by unanimous vote. It's, to this day, it's stuck in the House. It's House Bill 4536. If you want to call your state reps, ask them, what the hell is a holdup? What's the holdup? Why is it taking over 9 years for something this simple to be put into law? There was an article a couple of months ago about Governor Snyder, who had made an agreement to bring in 5,000 Syrian refugees and put them in a safe city in Michigan. I don't know if you saw that in the paper or not. I was, and I'm going to use plain language, please. I was so pissed off when I saw that. How is it that a governor, the government of Michigan, can bring in foreign refugees, and who knows who they are, but how can they bring in 5,000 foreign refugees and ignore the exonerees here in Michigan who've been wrongfully imprisoned? I say exonerees before refugees. That is fair. That's my motto, one of my mottos. So if you can, please call your state reps. House Bill 4536, tell them to get off. Tell them to get the lead out. And I'm not talking about the water in Flint. Tell them to get the lead out of their ass and get this bill passed.
Do we have another question?
I hope so, because we're just getting warmed up. We'll stay here all night.
I was wondering, the prosecutor and the detectives, they, when all the scientific evidence was brought forward and it all said you didn't do it, shouldn't that have at least told them, well, okay, if all this stuff says he didn't do it, then I guess he didn't do it. It's that, like, what was it? They still weren't convinced?
That's a very good question, and I'll tell you another fact that was proven. In my case, okay, the original vote in my case was 10-2 to acquit. We found out after I came home and during the course of a civil suit that I filed against the Clinton Township Police Department, after that original 10-2 vote to acquit, the trial judge, Michael Schwartz, actually stuck his head in the jury room. That's a federal violation, okay? He stuck his head in the jury room. He told the jurors that he thought I was guilty. The next day, the jury comes back guilty on all counts. That's how extreme some of these problems, and this is no BS, folks. This is all on record in federal courts. That's how extreme some of these wrongful convictions can, how far they can go, how far they can go off the rails. That's a fact. And it happens every day in this country, and it has to stop. And I'll keep fighting to the day that I die to make sure that this problem is corrected.
We've got another question right here in the back.
Can you explain the immunity? I'm not grasping why it was instituted in the first place. Why would a police officer or someone need immunity?
Well, Bill, I'm sure Bill has an explanation because he was a former police officer. So I'll let Bill go first, and I'll give you my opinion.
it's a relatively simple straight line. Government draws a circle around itself to protect itself. Even though it's supposed to represent all of us, it needs to say, it feels it needs to say, that when somebody is doing the government's business, that person should be protected from the outsiders. We are the outsiders.
So,
you would think that someone in government would be required to follow the rules, and when they don't, they would be subject to some sort of sanction or punishment. So the fact that immunity surrounds people in law enforcement is a very unfortunate fact. And other than the fact that they're protecting themselves, I'm not really sure what else I can tell you about that fact.
Well, you know, when as far as the immunity goes, as I said, I believe the law should apply equally to everyone, okay? When a prosecutor, a judge, a police officer, they all swear, they take an oath, they swear to uphold the law. Most of them do, and I respect most of the police officers. I've been saying this since the day that I've been home, especially the ones that put they're on the streets every day. They put their lives on the line every day. However, there are some crooked detectives, and the detectives are our main cause of these wrongful convictions. They have no conscience, okay? They can lie to people. So the United States Supreme Court said that if a detective is interrogating someone, they can lie to the witness. That's okay. It's legal, okay? In my case, where the lead detective, let me correct that for a minute, because I don't call them detectives now. I call them defectives, as they were in my case, okay? When you're allowed to hide evidence from a defendant or defense counsel and not pay a price for that, I mean, you're violating the law. Yet they do it every day because they know they can't be prosecuted. That's not fair. Is that plain enough for you? Can you understand?
So, Bill, in Devante's case, which I've been following, good job, is the police officer who I understand lied about the whole drawing and where everybody was, is he subject to immunity? Is that why I heard he got, like, dismissed or something? It didn't seem grave enough to me.
No, I guess there was a statute of limitations around the perjury charge that he faced. Conveniently, Judge Sullivan, in Devante's case, held off on essentially signing off on and gaveling Devante Sanford's complete and utter freedom out of the system without subject to potential punishment. He waited a matter of, five extra days before he signed that document, which essentially caused Devante's lawyers to keep him from providing the prosecutor with supposedly definitive statements and information about that commander or chief's misconduct. But the answer to your question is he slipped out of the window of potential charges for perjury. I don't know if something else is possible.
You know, another thing I want to point out about that particular issue, when Kim Worthy, the Wayne County prosecutor, said that she was not going to bring charges against Sergeant Tolbert, and she was, a lot of people were upset about that, me among them, okay? Kim Worthy had made a public statement saying that the reason she decided not to prosecute or bring charges against Sergeant Tolbert was because Devante had refused to testify against Sergeant Tolbert, which was a lie. Here's what happened. Devante was upset, his family was upset, we were all upset that Judge Sullivan had not signed that final order yet, okay? What Devante had told Kim Worthy was that as soon as you drop dismiss the charges, he'll be more than happy to testify against Sergeant Tolbert. So when Kim Worthy made that statement, that was an out-and-out lie.
Let me say thank you for all of the people in attendance tonight. If you get a chance to speak to your friends about the subject matter, we would love to be a part of a continuing conversation to spread the word that reform of our system is really necessary. Thank you so much for coming.
And if you, there's some information on the table outside. And again, if you have an opportunity, please visit provinginnocence.org. Okay. Tell your friends, thank you for your attention. God bless all of you. Thank you.